Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Istanbul, Turkey, is Ronald Suni, who's a professor of social and political history and the director of the Eisenberg Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Michigan, as well as a professor emeritus of political science and history at the University of Chicago. He is the author of They Can Live in the Desert But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ronald Suni.
Thank you for having me.
And Donald Trump, of course, is getting a lot of criticism today for in his statement on the 102nd anniversary of the Armenian Genocide for not using the word genocide, which none of his predecessors have used in any case. But the extra criticism comes from the extraordinary phone call that he made to President Erdogan, congratulating him for winning an election that is still being disputed by the OSCE and the Europeans, not to mention almost half of the population of Turkey, who happen to be the educated and urban half of the country. So you're in Turkey. Is there a sense of betrayal amongst the Turks who voted against Erdogan's power grab in this recent election?
First, let me say that there was one instance at which an American president, it was Ronald Reagan, who actually used the word genocide to describe the events of 1915. It's sort of forgotten, but it may be a footnote, but it did happen, and it's a nice thing to remember. But as you mentioned, it's true that in general, presidents of the United States, because of the alliance with Turkey, have refused to use that word. And going along basically with the Turkish government's point of view that this genocide never happened or it was a civil war or something else. The situation in Turkey today is a very odd one. They just had this election, as you mentioned. It was divided right down the middle, you know, 51.4%, 48.6%, despite the fact that all of the TV, all of the media was calling for the yes vote, pro-Erdogan vote, and very little chance for the other side to be heard. The other side, actually, many of the leading opponents of the yes vote were in jail. So it was a kind of lopsided thing, and yet it came so close. And it was a very close victory for Erdogan, as it turned out. People here, from what I've heard today, don't know what Donald Trump said. It hasn't really filtered down yet. They were more concerned that President Erdogan had made a somewhat conciliatory statement about not calling it a genocide, of course, but at least recognizing that Armenians had suffered 102 years ago. So it's an odd situation here. We had a small demonstration in the center of Istanbul, surrounded by police, of course. A small, even smaller counter-demonstration that seemed to be saying something odd about how the people who were commemorating the Armenian Genocide were tools of imperialism. It's a strange situation in this wonderful, beautiful city and this dynamic country that so many people don't know what happened 102 years ago. How indeed the Ottoman Empire ended and the Turkish Republic was founded.
But back to the congratulatory phone call from Donald Trump, congratulating Erdogan for winning, in quotes, the referendum. Have you had any sense of the impact that's had on those who voted against him? And it could be higher than the 48% that you mentioned, because the Europeans have suggested that there was some vote tampering. And as you mentioned, it wasn't a level playing field. What's your sense, though, of that? The idea that the American president had met shortly before that with the Egyptian dictator who took over in a military coup, General Sisi, that supposedly gave Assad some sense that maybe he can drop a few chemical warheads on his people because Donald Trump is transactional. And then Trump then turns around and congratulates Erdogan while the Europeans are disputing the results. And many people felt that undercut the moral authority of the United States and its democratic traditions. And so I'm just questioning you about what you are seeing there in Turkey in terms of the urban and educated people who I imagine feel a little bit undercut by our president.
I would say that after that, the referendum, the people I spoke to, and you can imagine who they would be, you know, students, faculty members, intellectuals of various kinds were in not only despondent, they were in some kind of despair, because the sense was that the election had not been fair. It had been very biased, very much one-sided. And yet, it was not a very resounding victory for Erdogan. So it's not that people are totally dismayed, but what you find is a real fear about what the future holds, particularly among young people, a sense that it's unpredictable what might go next and what, you know, this country holds for them, this new generation that's rising up. I'm an academic, and so I've been hanging out in academic settings and giving lectures and talking to people. And there, the sense is that here Turkey had built up over the last couple decades an incredible educational system, private universities that were being taught in English, high-class scholarship, recognition by what I would call the progressive Turkish and Kurdish intelligentsia of the Armenian genocide, that such an event did occur and that people had to come to terms honestly, frankly, with their own past. All of those things seem at the moment on the verge of being destroyed as the Erdogan government, in fact, is arresting and dismissing academics of all kinds, jailing journalists, etc. On the Trump side, why is this a surprise? Why is it a surprise that someone like Donald Trump would have sided with someone like General Sisi, who's, won power in a coup d'etat, is a kind of tyrant, has jailed his opposition, or would congratulate Erdogan on this dubious victory? We're going to see a lot more of that kind of thing. And as you sort of hinted in your question, the moral authority of the United States, which has also, you know, gone through a lot of shocks in the last 15 years, is really in tatters at the moment.
And again, I'm speaking with Ronald Suni, who is in Istanbul, Turkey. He is a professor of social and political history and the director of the Eisenberg Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Michigan, as well as a professor emeritus of political science and history at the University of Chicago. He's the author of They Can Live in the Desert But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide. So the other aspect, of course, of the connections between Erdogan and Trump are to do with business. I was just looking at a tweet the other day from Ivanka Trump congratulating or thanking President Erdogan for showing up at the opening of a Trump hotel, which a Turkish partner who's close to Erdogan is involved with. So is there any sense in Turkey that, I mean, let's face it, we've never had a president in the history of the United States, and this goes back to the Constitution where they put in the emoluments clause to prevent the profiting from the presidency. We've never had anybody in the presidency who's actually an active businessman. His sons and daughter are still running the company that he owns. He hasn't given it up. The brand has gone up in value. It's pretty hard not to see that even though a lot of people think his presidency is a disaster and it's going nowhere, on the other hand, the Trump brand has gone through the ceiling.
Yes, well, you use the word transactional. You know, this is a deal maker, and he's a person who's been very skillful, if not completely honest, in his business dealings. And you're probably going to see a lot more of that. He's obviously giving comfort to a lot of politicians, largely on the right, largely of the more authoritarian style in Europe. People like Marine Le Pen, who did pretty well, though she came in second in yesterday's election in France, or for a while at least, Vladimir Putin, Erdogan, Sisi, etc. The fact that he's more interested in a kind of strategic, instrumentalist, transactional relationship, America first and what's good for America, rather than thinking, as other presidents have done, Jimmy Carter and Barack Obama most notably, about human rights, about democracy, those kinds of things. This is going to be a good era for the next year or so, as long as he's president. for those with this kind of populist, nationalist, authoritarian streak in their governing style.
But could it be deeper in a way that Donald Trump's father was a developer, a real estate developer, but he built mostly built housing. And, of course, they got into trouble because of the public housing they were building. They didn't want to let African-Americans in. But Donald Trump discovered that the way to get rich is to target your real estate development for the super rich. And he's, in many ways, he helped turn New York into a magnet for the global elite who have certainly showed up there. And Trump Tower is full of millionaires and billionaires and oligarchs of all stripes. A lot of them are kleptocrats. And, you know, they have restrictions on co-ops in New York, but no such problem with any Trump property. If you got the money to pay for it, you're in there and you're quite welcome. And it seems to me that that is also sort of translating into his attitude to foreign policy. There's nobody at the State Department to as a check and balance. And I remember when he first started his campaign, one of the first photo ops, he presented this Indonesian fellow who was his buddy saying, we're going to do great deals with Indonesia. Well, this guy was the bag man for General Prabowo, the guy that lost the election. And so that's the way I see this man as somebody that is, in a way, in terms of his foreign policy, is still transacting the politics of kleptocracy.
It's very hard to easily write off Donald Trump because this is not simply, as you've indicated, an American problem or even a European problem. This is a global problem. Something fundamentally is going on in the world that's very different, that's more reminiscent, though it's not as bad as the 1930s. That is, if you go from Modi in India through the Middle East, the people we've mentioned, to Orban in Hungary, Kaczynski in Poland, Marie Le Pen and others, some who have been defeated, some who haven't been, Putin, etc. You have across the globe a phenomenon where people and certain leaders have turned against the more liberal globalization kinds of efforts, back into a kind of isolationism. The building of walls is a good symbol of that. And Donald Trump is articulating that, sort of more nationalism, more America first or Turkey first or whatever first, and an appeal to the kind of discontented peoples who have not done well in this neoliberal era. The irony is that Donald Trump, for all of his appeals to the Rust Belt, to the working class of Pennsylvania and Michigan and Ohio and Wisconsin, in fact, has created a government of billionaires, military men, and right-wing ideologues, none of whom, it seems to me, and I've been out of the country for a while, but I read carefully and listen carefully every day, and none of those people seem to have the immediate interest, except maybe to win the next election, of the sort of working-class people and middle-class people that put him in power.
Well, Ronald Sunni, just back to the 102nd anniversary of the Armenian Genocide, and you're there in Istanbul, Turkey. One of the aspects of it that historians don't often discuss, or at least focus on, is the economic side, if you will, of the murder of 1.5 million Armenians and driving them into the desert, which you've, of course, written about in your book, They Can Live in the Desert But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide. It's worth noting that the Armenians were fairly prosperous, and all of their properties, all of their homes, all of their possessions, all of their bank accounts were stolen and expropriated. And this is not unlike what the Nazis did with the Jews in Europe. They took their properties, took their money, took their art. We're still having famous paintings being disputed to this day. So do you think that aspect of the plunder, that not only was this about such an extraordinary inhumanity in terms of genocide, but was also there was this other motive, or at least perhaps a bonus, if you will, of economic plunder?
Absolutely, yes. And don't forget that, white Americans, European Americans did the same thing with Native Americans, appropriating property and benefiting from the expansion across the continent. Karl Marx once remarked that, capitalism was built on the primitive accumulation of capital. Well, he was talking about England and the enclosure movement, the driving of peasants off the land, the consolidation under the hands of large landowners. Well, in some places, like the late Ottoman Empire, you had what I would call the most primitive accumulation of capital. What they did was murder as many as they could or drive them into the desert and just take all the stuff and replace a largely Christian Greek Armenian and also Jewish bourgeoisie with a more native Muslim bourgeoisie. The properties were taken and then redistributed among people who were favored by the Ottoman government and then the successor government, the early government of the Turkish Republic. The origins of the Armenian genocide itself are very complicated, but certainly you've put your finger on one thing. There was a very great competition for land in Anatolia. Anatolia is basically the peninsula on which the modern Turkish Republic is built. There was a real competition between Kurds and Turks, Armenians, Assyrians, and others, particularly in eastern Anatolia, Armenians being driven off the land or their land confiscated, etc. And the genocide itself was in one disastrous movement, the elimination of one of those chief competitors. And so what was historically Armenia, if you go back centuries, is now Kurdistan. It's now largely occupied by the Kurdish people, who, by the way, to their credit, have officially and through their representatives recognized the genocide and in some ways apologized for the genocide. They see themselves now as victims, too, of the Turkish state. But that economic base to what occurred in 1915 was certainly powerful. It's not the only thing. There were international considerations. There was fear that by the Ottoman government that the Armenians were too close to the Russians, and Turkey and Russia were at war at the time. There were what I call affective dispositions, emotional constructions of the Armenians as a subversive, untrustworthy, deceptive group that had to be eliminated in order to make the empire safe. So there were a lot of complicated things, but I think your point is a very good one, that underneath many of these things were economic competition for limited resources, namely land.
Well, just in the last minute, Ronald Suni, why is it that the State of Israel and the Jewish diaspora have been so much more successful in terms of keeping the memory of the Holocaust alive and making people aware of what the Nazis did, whereas the Armenians have been much less successful? Certainly they haven't been able to convince the Turkish government to admit to what happened. What do you think the explanation for that is?
That's a complicated question with a complicated answer. The Holocaust, the Judaicide by the Nazis, occurred in Europe. It was much more visible. It occurred in a period of mass media. The Nazis were totally defeated by the Allies and eventually had to come to terms with what they had done and recognize it. And one must give credit to the Germans in particular that they very fruitfully and very effectively, with much pain and difficulty, did recognize what had occurred during the Second World War and before. The Ottoman Empire was defeated, but it very quickly was replaced by the Turkish Republic, which wasn't defeated, which eliminated some of the peoples, like the Greeks, by population exchange, etc., and created a new country here in a war of liberation against foreign invasions and others. And so it was immediately brought into the family of nations without any need to recognize what had happened or what occurred before that republic was formed. And it occurred a long time ago. The people who were destroyed, those who immigrated, those who were deported, like the Armenians, were so traumatized that it took a generation before they themselves clearly articulated to themselves and to the world what had happened.
Well, Ronald Suni, I thank you very much for joining us from Istanbul. And again, I've been speaking with Ronald Sunu. He's a professor of social and political history and the director of the Eisenberg Institute for Historical Studies at the University of Michigan, as well as a professor emeritus of political science and history at the University of Chicago. He's the author of They Can Live in the Desert But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide. And he joined us from Istanbul, Turkey. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with a Turkish scholar who is considered the Sherlock Holmes of the Armenian Genocide.